Revolution. And today, on the podcast, I usually say coming from the lower bottoms of West Oakland, and I have to stop saying that because I have moved locations and are no longer in West Oakland. I am in East Oakland. And for most of you that don't know jack shit about Oakland, you probably don't care. But for those that do know about Oakland, I'm not trying to get fucked up in these streets for misrepresenting where I'm broadcasting from. That being said, today I try to be honest with the show. So I was trying to do a show on the history of Filipinos, or I should say the history of American colonization in the Philippines. And I asked a good friend of mine who's a professor. I said, hey, do you know any Filipino professors that would want to do this project? And she responds back, yes, I definitely do. And she connects me with a gentleman, and I hit him up, and he goes,
Am I a gentleman?
You were cool enough to be like, that's not really what I do.
It's a little piece of what I do. It's not what I do. It's a piece of what I do.
And so the person you hear talking is Professor Dylan Rodriguez. He's a professor in the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. And he sent me his latest book, White Reconstruction, Domestic Warfare and the Logics of Genocide. So the first question I have to ask you, first of all, thank you for coming on.
No, it's an honor.
I thought it was really funny that I'm asking for a Filipino historian and I just get the first Filipino that our mutual friend knows.
Good enough. Hey, my first language is Tagalog. That makes me fucking Filipino, right?
Is that race reductionism?
I don't know. Hey, look, I was born stateside, but my first language is Tagalog. So fuck that, I'm Filipino.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, straight up. No, I was first in my family born in the U.S., but my language in the household was Tagalog. They call it in the Philippines. They fucked it all up and they call it Filipino now. But it's Tagalog. It's one of the many, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dialects. But no, that's literally my first language is Tagalog. And I, as my mom's assimilationist mythology goes, I learned English through Big Bird and Grover and Oscar and shit on Sesame Street. But I don't know how true that is. No, so our friend was correct. I'm very much Filipino.
And you actually did write a book about
yes, Filipinos. That's what I'm saying. No, she was right on point. Like, this is, you know, thinking about the long colonial, you know, and for a period intensely genocidal presence of the United States in the Philippines is a piece of what I do. It is not like what I would define as what I do. It is a big piece of what I do, a significant piece of what I do. But you know, then you got the book that I just finished doing, and you kind of see that is one piece of a larger project that I've been obsessed with for most of my life now.
But I thought it was funny because as he's like, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, well, I want to do this thing. He's like, well, maybe I should. I was like, no.
I know Filipino historians. You know what I mean? Like, I was saying, hey, look, if you want to talk to somebody who is a historian of the Philippines, that is not my lane. I know my lane. I'm a scholarly shit talker. That's probably I'm somewhere between an irresponsible creative writer and a scholarly shit talker. So if you want a real historian, I know I have a Rolodex with like 25, you know, 30 real solid, you know, unassailable Filipino and Filipino American historians that I can send you to.
I think scholarly shit talker is better. I do want to ask you one on the Philippines real quick. One quick question. There's a documentary, and I don't know if you've seen it, about Imelda Marcos.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Kingmaker?
This is the one that, okay, so like there's a whole beef mm-hmm. that my Filipino colleagues have, and I, which I include myself in, there's a whole beef we have with that documentary. Because what you have, that is a shining example of a white, in this case, a white woman, woman documentary filmmaker who gets access to all kinds of shit because of her race and gender and, mm-hmm. and nationality for that matter. Mm-hmm. And essentially replicated and in the words of other colleagues, including another documentary, the Filipino woman documentary filmmaker, essentially plagiarized a pre-existing project on Imelda. But the difference is that she was able to get access to all this stuff because of her status, race, gender, and nationality wise. So yeah, so I've seen that documentary and it's okay, it's all right. But I have another colleague whose name I'll find in a second that did the original take.
So you're saying somebody else who happens to be Filipino,
yes,
literally made that same, or had that same take, or made the same documentary.
In essence, yeah. Word. It's
word.
It's Ramona Diaz.
Word.
Ramona Diaz wrote a film in 2003. Didn't just write it. It produced did a documentary film. Ramona Diaz did a documentary film in 2003 called Imelda. So don't get it twisted, people. It's a running time of 103 minutes. I'm looking at the fucking Wikipedia page right now. That's the beauty of the internet. But yeah, I just wanted to get the year right. I want to get the year right so I could, not get sued for whatever.
That's 16 years or so. This one just came out in 17 years before. Yeah.
No shit, right? No shit. So this is a big issue with a lot of colleagues. And obviously with Ramona's righteously pissed about it, but everybody out there, before you go watch, the whitewashed version, go see Imelda by Ramona Diaz. Tell your library to get it. Tell your university to get it. Tell your school to get it. Go find it. Imelda.
I have to see it now because I don't know that much about the mark. And I think that's another reason why I was looking for someone in academia, because I don't know that much about the Marcos regime other than the little things I've read here and there. I think Filipino history in general, unless you are Filipino, you probably don't get much about it, right?
Here's the thing, though. Depending on your generation, you probably have a little bit better proximity to this history than you realize, because what I remember, being a kid of the 80s, right? What I remember, my take, having been born and raised in the United States on the East Coast in Northern Virginia, among a community of both petty bourgeois professionals that worked in the DC area and expatriates who left the Philippines because they were going to be assassinated by the Marcos regime, right? Like, my godfather's this great scholar named Walden Bello, who's now back in the Philippines, but he lived in the US for a long time because Marcos was going to kill him.
All you got to know
is this motherfucker, Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan, they would take regular trips to the Philippines and make, a big spectacle of literally dancing in a ballroom with Imelda and Ferdinand Marcos. So the United States was no critic of this politically homicidal martial law regime in the Philippines. They are absolutely supportive of it. The Marcos regime would not have existed without the United States and without Ronald Reagan's open, ongoing, vigorous support. And they only jumped ship. They only jumped ship when the people decided that they were going to throw the Marcoses out of that palace. So that's my memory of it. My other memory is this bald assassination of Ninoy Aquino. I'll never forget that. I was probably 10 years old or something like that. And seeing the images of him all bloodied up because they shot him. They assassinated him in cold blood as soon as he walked out of the airplane.
As he walks out of an airplane, and he was locked up for how many, I forget how many years was locked
no,
up.
He was an expatriate, comes back on an airplane, and they killed him in cold blood, and they did it for a reason. And that's my memory. That to me is what the Marcos regime is. That image of Nino Aquino's, corpse with blood all over his barong, and the image of Ronald Nancy Reagan dancing with Imelda and Ferdinand Marcos. That's it. That's the truth of America right there too. Not just the Philippines, that's the truth of America. The United States, I should say, not America, the United States.
Let's, if you don't mind, can we stay on this for a little bit?
Yeah, of course. This shapes everything about what I've done and how I think since I've had memories. Follow me? Since I've had memories. So this shit is central to it, right? The route that I've gone as a teacher, a writer, and all this other kind of stuff. Like, it is shaped by everything that we're talking about right now in these first 10 minutes.
Now, I don't know if I told you, I have all these beige children that are half Filipino.
Right on.
So I feel like I should know a little bit about the political goings on of where their mom's family is from. Mm-hmm. And my ex-in-laws don't really talk about it too much. Mm. And they definitely watched a fair share of news coming from the Philippines. Whenever I would come over, I'd always, you know, watch some of that. And I do follow some sites like Rappler, for some news on the Philippines. But I don't really see too many people talk about it in mainstream media, other than when Duterte says something like super crazy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's repeated on mainstream media, but almost in a comical way, kind of like, look at this silly dictator of this oh so funny banana republic. But when you watch that, even the again, I haven't seen the original documentary, which I now have to see. That scene where Aquino steps off the plane and is murdered is really powerful. And really frightening. Now, was he a true leftist in the sense of being
No, he was not. He's not what I would call in any way a leftist, right? He was somebody who had widespread support simply because he was for a semblance of liberal democracy. Like what you got to give him credit for is that he was a militant critic of martial law, a militant opponent of martial law. Now, in terms of his own politics, like, you know, I wouldn't categorize him as left in any way, just like, you know, Cory Aquino, his surviving spouse, she was in most ways when she became president, you know, people wanted to, kind of iconize her, especially upon her passing. But she was, if anything, she was an antagonist of the Philippine left. Right. And
really,
but Ninoy Aquino's significance is really just, it's as much about the, unapologetic, kind of politically repressive terror of the martial law regime as it was about his own politics. I would argue it's probably more about that. It's more about overt, unapologetic state terror, you know, because that assassination will never die in the minds, in terms of the image of it, the meaning of it, the in fact, I think you don't have somebody like Duterte doing what he does without that particular moment in Philippine, in you know, kind of the last half century Philippine history. You don't have, because what it shows is that if the Marcos regime will do that, well, shit, this Duterte, he's going to just start declaring war on people who are addicts, which is literally what he's done, right? He's going to start killing people in the street who he decides, and his people, his cops decide, he will just mow them down in the street unapologetically and win a significant popular support to do so. Right. Because that's the difference, is that with the assassination of Aquino, you'd have to talk to somebody more qualified than me. But my sense of it is that this was not something that necessarily had broad popular support, that assassination. Right. But what it did was it had a broad popular effect. The difference is that you have somebody like Duterte now who is mowing people down in the street, extrajudicially, uh-huh. You know, outside any kind of process. And this fucker has support, right?
And so, he has support over here too, as well.
Hell
expats.
Yeah. Hell yeah, he does. So this is the thing, man. Is that the reason why, in many cases, you don't hear a ton about the Philippines and Philippine politics in so-called mainstream media here is, number one, it's a de facto colonial militarized outpost of the United States anyways, right? So in that sense, it is structurally and symbolically insignificant until it's not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Right? And then on the other hand, I'm convinced of this too, is what has morbidly amused me and many other people for the last 5-6 years is that Duterte was Trump before Trump.
Yeah.
Duterte's ascendancy is like a Philippine so-called third world mirror image of what you saw happen in 2015, 2016 with this fucker that's about to get either thrown out of office, or maybe he'll somehow stay another 4 years. I don't know yet. but that's who Duterte is, man. That's why Duterte is Trump's first cousin. They're first cousins. They are brothers from another mother. They are the Trans-Pacific mirror image of each other. And so there's a certain kind of absurdity to that, and a certain kind of, I think, national sense of national shame to that. Not necessarily that they mirror each other's politics and demeanor, but that in this case it's the United States following the Philippines. When the assumption is always it's the other way around, that it's the colony that follows the colonizer. No, man. In this case, you got your president who is mirroring this regime of terror that's been instituted and won populist support in the Philippines, right across the ocean.
Do you think it's because he's kind of more so than Bolsonaro? I think Bolsonaro in Brazil is a little more buffoonish in a cartoonish sense. And I feel like Duterte is a lot less cartoonish because he's so fucking serious.
Because Duterte rules on terror. And there's, look, there's a reason why fascism is such a persistent force in modern history, right? I mean, there's something about this kind of romance with state terror that, liberals and even people that think about themselves as far to the left of liberals, right? They don't take it seriously enough. There's something that is seductive to people about unapologetic, persistent, normalized exercises of state terror. There's something seductive about it. And it's not, I don't mean seductive in a kind of necessarily in a happy sense, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's seductive in the sense that people feel like they need to side with that.
Yes.
Right. And I'm not even saying people necessarily feel empowered by it. Right. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes they're scared shitless by it. Right. But they're like, oh, fuck, I need to side with that. And I see that shit that has, if you want to segue to a broader conversation, I mean, that's what I see happening around me all the time. In recent days and months.
I definitely saw it. That was the first thing I saw. So. I'm getting ready to do a show with one of your fellow professors at the University of California, Riverside, Mike Davis, on whatever day that Capitol riot was, the 6th.
January 6th.
And I send him the email link to get on the show, and he goes, hey, man, we're going to have to reschedule because I'm watching this shit go down at the Capitol. And so
that's where Mike and I differ. I would have said, let's do this shit live. Right now, and have the sounds of these fucking right wing white nationalists, multicultural white supremacist cops in the background trying to do their coup. And let's have it right now. Let's talk over it right now. Hey, all respect to Mike Davis. I'm just messing with you.
That's where he and I differ. I tend to tune a lot of that shit out, right? Mm. And my mom sends me a message. And my mom goes, hey, are you watching what's going on? And now that my show just got canceled or my whole day is off, I'm like, what the fuck's going on? And I turn on the stream of whatever it was, CNN or whatever, and my mouth dropped open.
Yeah, right.
Because they were in the Capitol building. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing kind of a bit of a reductionist conversation, which was like, well, if this was BLM, I was like, first of all, these are the same people that drove to Kenosha,
yes,
to protect police.
You want to talk about a false equivalence? Like, we can't even that comparison. That's all over MSNBC, CNN, even Fox is doing it, right? Like, it's everywhere. Because if this was BLM, there is no BLM. There is no BLM. That is remotely comparable to anything that you saw happen on January 6th.
Thank you.
Right. If this thing that y'all are calling BLM, if it comes within 90 degrees of separation from what you saw happen on January 6th, there is no more BLM. There's now an open campaign on Black people in an explicit way, as much as it's been normalized and implicit for, five fucking centuries. You know what I mean?
Then I fucked up. And I watched the video of that woman get shot.
Hmm.
I clicked something.
That's right.
And I don't know if you saw it.
I did see it.
Anyone that's watching, if you, I'm not going to suggest anybody watch it. This is how I feel. I don't like watching snuff films of people that look like me dying on TV.
Yeah.
And if you, and people getting executed by the state, not a fan.
Yep. Me too. I'm with you.
And one, and also there's a, what's the word? Schadenfreude.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that going on to a degree, but we have to understand that it hasn't worked out real well for the U.S. when they open fire on their own people.
Yeah.
And we have a history of doing it. You can go back to the Bonus March. You can go back to Kent State.
Yeah.
It doesn't work out real well when we open fire on our own people. And both of those situations I just mentioned was white people getting mowed down.
Well, hey, look, that's why I will make a humble and modest revision to your statement. There is no we here. There's no we here. Here's what I saw when I witnessed that video of Babbitt being shot by the Capitol Police, right? This is before the information came out about her biography and who she was and all that stuff. That moment was an intra-police conflict.
Mm.
That's how I saw that, right? Mm. And I'm not saying, and again, state terror, state violence, homicidal and otherwise is what it is. Follow me? I mean, it is what it is. Like, I'm not for it, and in particular, if it's this state. So there is no we. There's no we that I'm going to identify with here. But as somebody who is witnessing this, I see it for, this is an intra-police conflict. This is not what people want to call it, which is simply white terrorism. It's not simply, an act of insurrection or a coup or whatever. That is not simply what it is, right? This is the letter I sent to American Studies Association membership this morning, because I'm currently serving as president of the American Studies Association. But one of the things I felt obligated to respond to was some of this liberal progressive kind of reaction, a lot of pearl clutching, right, around trying to recuperate some kind of faith and optimism in the promise of the United States of America's national project and its government, its state form and all this shit. It's like, no, what you saw go down on the 6th was a police action. I think the way I phrased it in this letter to American Studies Association people was, it was a militant expression of police power. And it brought a certain militant expression of police power into conflict with this minor arm of the police called the Capitol Police. And the reason why, the more information that comes out, the more it affirms, what I'm arguing here, which is that, I just read, I think late last night, maybe early this morning, that the sergeants at arms in Congress, that they insistently and stubbornly delayed any call to the National Guard, despite the pleas from the Capitol Police, for at least an hour after the Capitol had been taken siege by these self-declared patriots. Right. So it's like, it's a conflict. It's a conflict. It's an intra-police conflict. They don't know what the fuck to do.
And what's so crazy about it is their leader, who they went there to support, bailed on them and watched the shit.
Did.
From a fucking bunker drinking champagne, and there's video of it. They live streamed the shit.
Hey, Jason, he wasn't drinking any fucking champagne, man. He was on Big Macs and Diet Cokes. Keep it real. You and I are drinking champagne. Right now, right? You and I are drinking champagne right now at 10:39 in the morning. That fucker was not drinking champagne.
I saw a little bit of it because a friend posted it. My co-host on the live stream, Pascal Robert of Black Agenda Report, he posted it.
All right, bar, hell, shout out to Black Agenda Report, badass.
We got to get you on the live stream.
They're on my homepage. Yeah,
we got to get you on the live stream.
Right on.
So I'm watching this shit, and we're talking about it. We did a big show Saturday with a bunch of cats, and talked about it. And I have a friend. And I haven't spoken to this woman in some time. And I knew her through my ex. Nice woman. Never had any problems.
Here we go.
She's taking pictures, Dylan, from the shit. She's taking selfies from the top of the Capitol.
And it looks like a
picnic.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Hey, Jason, that's what fucking lynchings look like.
Right?
I'm being real. That's what lynch photographs look like. Before we had the word selfies, the most famous postcard, the most famous lynching image in the history of the United States looks like a fucking selfie, doesn't it?
Yeah. Where the two brothers are hanging and everybody's kind of like, yeah. It looked like that. And I was shocked, first of all. And the comments on the pictures that she's posting are not positive. I think her group of friends is shocked, and I don't know what sent her down whatever right-wing rabbit hole again. I haven't talked to this woman in some time. Right. The last time we spoke, she had come to see us in Philadelphia and got us a hotel room so we didn't have to sleep in the van, mm-hmm. and hung out with us all night, not talking any crazy shit. And, you know, fast forward 6 years later, and she's smiling selfies.
Yeah, man.
At the Capitol. And it kind of, it again, before we start recording, when I told you I was like, 2012 was the year for me when I started to realize that things are very different right now. Obama's second term.
Yeah.
For a lot of people projected onto Barack Obama who they wanted him to be. And I don't know if you're if you've read any Adolf Reed or a fan of Adolf Reed at all, but he called
sometimes I hate him.
He gets that a lot.
Yeah.
But he called out who Barack Obama was in 1996.
I respect that.
And it, whew. Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy to see kind of this backlash now. That people have, like, I think that, and you may disagree with me here, there's all these figures about all these people voted for Trump. I was like, you know, people talk a lot about how horrible of a candidate Hillary Clinton was, and that was a big reason why Donald Trump won.
Right.
I feel that same way about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I think he was equally as horrible as a candidate.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people that did not want to vote for Joe Biden. But on the same hand, they didn't want to vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, this is part of the dilemma, right? Is we got to figure out what the fuck to do with electoral politics as this disciplinary action against people who have radical imagination, who want fucking freedom, who want some version of liberated self-determination, who want an abolition of police terror, of anti-black state violence, of anti-blackness generally, of fucking colonial power. Like, you know, these communities of people, it's first of all, we got to stop using that phrase preaching to the choir all the time. Number one is disrespectful to people who actually preach to choirs. And that's number one. And that's real, right? Like, because I know people who actually, they fucking preach to choirs. And that shit is an art form. It is a discipline and it is complex. It's not like you just have people approving you all the time. There's fights when people preach to the choir. Right.
Thank you.
That's number one. And number two, I'm not sure that the choir is singing the same song. I'm not sure that they are of the same religion. I'm not sure they're even fucking religious. Right. So we got to stop with that metaphor all the time, because it's number one, it's trivializing. And number two, it's dangerously simplifying. And what you just said speaks to that. I'm going to send you something in a minute. But I remember how I felt during the first Obama campaign. Kind of knowing he was probably going to win, right? And then so he wins in this big sweep in 2008. And I should have sent this to you before we started recording, but I wrote a polemic. I think I called it Inaugurating Multiculturalist White Supremacy, is I think what I called it. It was something like that. And I had nowhere to publish it. I was just pissed, and I was frankly like. In my own little arrogant way, I was like disappointed in my colleagues and my friends and others who were way too invested in Obama, like it was meaningful, you know, like it was meaningful in, well, put it this way, like it was meaningful in ways that it really wasn't. Right? I understand how it's meaningful, right? But that it was meaningful in ways that it wasn't and it never could be. And anybody who was paying even modest attention to something that we want to call U.S. history would know that, right? And it was to say that there's something horrific about the force, the disciplinary force, the dumbing, stupidifying force that, and by stupidifying, I don't mean it's stupendous. I mean, it makes you stupid, yeah. Right? The way that electoral politics exerts on political imagination among people who see themselves as beyond this kind of fake ass liberal conservative spectrum that defines mainstream electoral politics. And it's really not even that, right? Like, it's really just versions of conservative, neoconservative politics or some neoliberalism mixed in. I mean, that's really what it is. So it's like, who gives a fuck about the quality of these candidates, right? The problem is the terrain, right? The problem is the problematic. The problem is the paradigm in and of itself that people understand, you know, these electoral campaigns to be the limit and the definition of political power. That's the problem, right? And this is not to dispute those who find a necessity to engage in struggle within that very delimited political terrain. I respect that. Like, one of the people I look up to all the time, who I fucking take instruction from all the time, Barbara Ransby, based in Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she is very clear about this, right? That this is an important terrain. So, like, I respect what she's doing. Like, it's hard for me to swallow at times, but I'll follow that lead, right? But at this very same time, I think it is the other thing that Barbara talks about all the time that sometimes gets lost because people get caught up in, you know, doing their pro Bernie Sanders thing or whatever. Is that it's the delimiting, kind of restrictive, incarcerating force that electoral politics has, especially the national stage, has on political imagination. That's one of the primary enemies, and we see it happening right now. That's how January 6th happened from the other side. That's how that shit happened.
And what's really interesting too, I had a conversation a few months ago, right before the Democratic and Republican National Conventions, with a hip hop journalist, actually, a brother named Justin Hunt, and he's got a pretty big hip hop channel, The Company Man is what it's called, and which is funny for a guy that does like punk and metal music. I always interview hip hop guys. We were talking about the failures of the Democratic National Convention not to have regular, everyday people on there that kind of symbolized what they're supposed to be about. The Republican convention had the people that had the guns in St. Louis. Remember the rich white family that had the guns when the BLM marchers came by? Yep. They had those people there at their convention and people like that. Whereas the Republican convention kind of had these weird displays of multiculturalism, which you talk a lot about in your book, which I appreciate. And he was like, why isn't Chris Smalls at the Democratic National Convention?
Yeah.
why isn't Hold My Blunt Guy? I was like, who's Hold My Blunt Guy? He goes, remember when that dude was breaking those windows in Minnesota and you see a guy run up to him and go, hey, man, we're not here to break property. We're here to call out the police.
Yeah.
And the dude says something to the kids and says, I'll kick your ass. And the kid looks over to his friend and says, hold my blunt to go fight this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like he's right. Yeah. Like, that to me galvanizes more people to your cause, real people, if you're supposed to be the party of the working class. Yeah. But more and more and more, I think more people are realizing that the Democratic Party, especially with this administration that's come in and says nothing's going to fundamentally change. And you have Kamala Harris, say what you will about Kamala Harris. She's kind of been a Democratic Party loyalist from the beginning of her days here in the Bay Area. Hey, Joe Biden.
Hey, look, let's not get it twisted about either of them. They're not merely Democratic. Well, I shouldn't say not merely. By being Democratic Party loyalists, let's also foreground how they are both police loyalists.
Very much so. Joe Biden has been a law and order person pretty much since the beginning. Yep. And he's also been one of those, let me work with the Republican Party and let me dismantle a lot of the New Deal frameworks.
All the above.
So that's who's in charge, and bringing in more Obama people more BlackRock people, more McKinsey people, more military industrial complex people. So
this is a return to respectability. That's what's being celebrated right now. This is a return to respectable exercise of police power in all the different ways you want to interpret and extrapolate the notion of police power. That's what this is. It's a celebration of a renormalization of the terror that is the asymmetrical terror that is the United States, which means it's domestic, it is global warfare. It is a respectable, renovation of it and an attempted recalibration and renormalization. That's what everyone, hopefully y'all out there know what I mean by everyone. That's what everyone, that's what everyone, give me some poetic license here. That's what everyone is fucking celebrating.
Yeah.
Because they're fucking embarrassed, because they're embarrassed by the, disrespectful and non-respectable and, blatant displays of reactionary, so-called hateful, fascistic and proto-fascistic and even in some cases proto-genocidal politics by the current administration. I mean, it's a return to respectability. This is America in quotes. It's America at its finest, and that's kind of what that book I sent you is thinking about, right? Is like how these little moments of kind of self-declared, self-valorizing reform are actually what define this asymmetry of terror that the United States lives on, that it relies on, that it is. That is what the United States is this constant process.
So let's get into your book a little bit.
All right.
Because we could riff on this forever. This is from the back of the book, and then I'm going to read some from the book. We are in the fray of another signature moment in the long history of the United States as a project of anti-Black and racial colonial violence. Long before November 2016, white nationalism, white terrorism, and white fascist statecraft proliferated. Thinking across a variety of archival, testimonial, visual, and activist tests from Freedmen's Bureau documents and the Join LAPD hiring campaign to Barry Goldwater's hidden tattoo in the Pelican Bay prison strike, Dylan Rodriguez counter-narrates the long post-civil rights half century as a period of white reconstruction in which the struggle to reassemble the ascendancy of white being permeates the political and institutional logics of diversity, inclusion, formal equality, and quote unquote multiculturalist white supremacy.
Man, I think everybody just tuned out listening to you read all that shit.
No, they did not. I read this shit very well.
I'm going to send you $5 for reading that. I appreciate that.
So there was a chapter you have in here called Mass Incarceration as Misnomer. And our mutual friend and I'm going to try not to name her because I don't know if she wants me to call her out, because I'll call that motherfucker out. We have conversations about, and she's a prison was a prison. I'm assuming you don't.
I'd
say you still are. I don't think you just wake up one day and be like, I'm prison's yay.
Our friend is a longtime person that's been engaged in that abolitionist struggle before it was cool, before it was sexy, before everybody in the media decided they wanted to call themselves abolitionists some kind of weird way. No. She's an old head. She's an old head 21st century abolitionist.
She is that. And I read Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow. I didn't read it right when it came out.
Right.
But I did read it way before the documentary 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm better than anybody. I'm context.
Yeah. Right on.
But I followed up on that book with James Forman Jr.'s Locking Up Our Own, which I thought was a much deeper dive. And I don't know Michelle Alexander. Maybe you do. I don't think she wrote that book to be the definitive text on mass incarceration.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I read the book when it first came out. I was actually on a panel with her. The book was just fresh out off the press, and so I think I was probably one of the first group. I probably was in that first group of people who read the book. And I said this to Michelle on the panel we were at. I'm sure she doesn't remember this because she's been on like probably tens of thousands of panels since then. But it was at UCLA. It was a commemoration of UCLA's kind of inauguration of their of what basically is their ethnic studies compendium of departments and programs and whatnot. And I was on there on a panel with Michelle, and I expressed to her how puzzled I was by one particular aspect of her book, because I had a set of critiques of her analysis in terms of where her analysis was going, and also of her of the substance of what she was drawing from. So I'm not going to get into that here, but I will just pick on one particular thing that I keep picking on, because I think to her credit, it got her thinking at some level about what she was doing. But early in that book, she makes reference to a document from the National Urban League of all organizations, right? As a Black organization, it is not one of the more radical ones. It's to the contrary, right? It has to be fairly conservative, very respectability oriented, whatnot. Mm-hmm. But she quotes from a document. I think it was a white paper or something like that. But it was a publicly available document that the Urban League put out in the early to mid 80s, and they were calling out the kind of early stages of the so-called war on drugs and kind of what we now call gentrification, but the anti-Black versions of gentrification that were unfolding rapidly during that period of time. They use the term genocide. They use the term genocide in the document to describe what was happening to Black people in the United States as a direct outcome of what the state was doing in its policing, criminalization, and incarceration infrastructure. Right? They said this is potentially genocidal against Black communities around the United States. I'm paraphrasing, but they use the term genocide. And what was stunning in reading that, it was number one, it's the first I had read of that particular document, right? Like, I know I'm familiar, I'm probably deeply familiar with the long history of Black radicals and Black revolutionaries who use the terms of genocide to describe the condition of the United States and its global reach, right? So there's that. But this is the first I'd read of the National Urban League using that term. And then there was no follow-up. There was no analytical follow-up to that statement by the Urban League in this book, right? And so the question I posed to Michelle at that time was, well, Michelle, what would happen in your book if you actually followed through with that analysis, right? Or just took it seriously as an analysis of what's going on here, that calling it the new Jim Crow, which people forget, the book disavows the analogy in, I think, the next to last chapter, right? It says it's really not a new Jim Crow, right? Shit is much better now and Black kids can try to be president. Like, she literally says something like that, right? Which hey, look, and this is to Michelle's credit, in the years since that book, it's been 10 years now, Michelle's come out and she's become much more identified with an abolitionist critique of that book than she is with the original kind of like liberal progressive reformist criminal justice reform framework of that book. I've been more generous in my take on her work, because the book is one moment in her public intellectual life, right? So like we can all have a kind of take on that, and we should, because it's so widely read. Like, millions of people have probably read that book. It's gotten so much traction in Black communities, especially, you know, Black church communities, Black civil rights generation, all that. So it's like we have to be attentive to that, and that's also why we need to be deeply critical of it. And Michelle is much more, I think, engaged with the organizers, the activists, the artists, the scholars, the lawyers, and others who have been doing the work of radically challenging the asymmetrical domestic war of policing and incarceration, right? The so-called prison industrial complex, and so forth and so on, right? She's been much more engaged with that community, ironically, after the publication of that book than she was before. And that's indicative in what she's done and said since the publication of that book, where now she is becoming much more sympathetic and at times is explicitly identifying herself with abolitionist analysis and community than before. And frankly, that was one of the beefs I had with the new Jim Crow to begin with, was that it had a real kind of, in my view, a kind of snarky and dismissive treatment of abolitionist scholarship and analysis, right? It's just kind of like, oh yeah, these people are crazy. That's the flavor you got from it, right? But I don't think that's where she's at now. So I want to say that. I want to say that and also indicate that that book is part of the reason why this phrase mass incarceration has become so popular. And I actually think not only is it the wrong phrase, I think it's potentially and pragmatically a dangerous phrase. Right. Because it's in, you know, I'll be simplistic for a minute. Right. It's not mass incarceration. It's asymmetrical incarceration. right? It's anti-Black incarceration. It is not mass implies that there is a relative, a relative equity of representation, right? That it's mass, right? When you say mass, you mean mass, right? I'm assuming you mean what you say when you say mass incarceration, right? But then if you just glance at the data, there is no way that you could reasonably refer to this condition as mass incarceration. This is targeted, right? And when you're talking about specific populations of people, specific, you know, profiles of people who are the ones that are targeted for policing, for criminalization, for prosecution and incarceration, that is no longer adequately described by a phrase like mass incarceration. That is what you would probably call something closer to war, right? Where you have an identified target population that you're going to exert normalized state violence on every day. And also, not only that, but you're going to cultivate a kind of massive cultural structure that rationalizes and vindicates the state for waging that asymmetrical policing and carceral war on those people. That's war. I'm sorry, that's war.
Now, this gets into what I wanted to take from your book, actually, where you have a chapter, and let's get in the Wayback Machine to, I think this is from, 2009 or so?
Did that seem way back?
Right.
Doesn't it?
Right. Think about that shit for a minute.
I know.
We got out of high school in the 90s. Think about that shit for
a minute. That's right.
So this is the Brennan Commission.
Yeah.
What year is this? This is
2011, I want to say.
Yeah, so this is right before the second term of Obama. So we have Black people everywhere. Yeah. We got a colored president, colored DOJ, colored people everywhere. just everywhere colored.
You sound like some of these people in the Inland Empire.
I'm not saying it to complain about the makeup of my neighborhood, where there is colored people everywhere. I do live in Oakland. Colored as shit. So I'm going to read from the book right here, and stop me if you want to.
I'm not stopping.
Paraphrase and make it quick. I saw this. I highlighted like two pages because I wanted to read it. This is the Brennan Center Conference. So Eric Holder is there, who's the U.S. Attorney General, a bunch of federal prosecutors, police officials, a former president of the National Rifle Association.
It's 2014 this came out. What you're reading, this is the policy report from the Brennan Center for Justice, came out 2014. Y'all listen, can find it online. It's called Federal Prosecution for the 21st Century. That's the document that Jason's about, that I'm writing about, that Jason's going to be, I think, reading from.
Yes. Yeah. So you have a former chair of the American Conservative Union. So this is some law enforcement talk, right? This conference offers an opportunity to assess the way federal prosecutors can shift priorities. It will allow us to hear how state and local law enforcement can innovate so that safety does not come with the high costs of unnecessary incarceration. And it will gather the nation's top budget experts to explore how economic incentives can steer policy wisely or unwisely throughout the system. We are deeply grateful to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder for his encouragement for this work and his presence today. We are appreciative as well to the law enforcement leaders who will speak out in this conference. The Brennan Center works to reform the systems of democracy and justice. We seek to ensure that American institutions follow core values. Yeah. Thus, we are committed to ending mass incarceration as a mission for our organization. And you go on to say this conference served as the basis for the Blue Ribbon Brennan Center report, Federal Prosecution for the 21st Century, a far-reaching document that recommends concrete reforms to federal prosecution practices to support 21st century criminal justice policies. Echoing and revising the conference mission statement, the report suggests a criminal justice approach that would reorient prosecutor incentives and practices toward the twin goals of reducing crime and reducing mass incarceration. While the report reneges on the conference's commitment to ending, quote unquote, mass incarceration in exchange for merely, quote unquote, reducing it, the authors provide no clarifying remarks. And of course, you go on.
That's a fancy academic scholarly way of saying that these proclamations, these grandstands that think tanks make, that elected officials make, that I don't know if they're well-intentioned or not. I don't know how useful it is to try to read intentions, but seemingly well-intentioned professions of commitment by, district attorneys and attorneys general and even chiefs of police sometimes will make about ending mass incarceration. It's a meaningless statement. What does it mean to end mass incarceration? It doesn't mean abolition. We know that, right? We know that these people are not abolitionists. Now I would give them more room if these people were actually tying their statements and their grandstands about ending mass incarceration to abolition or even something that was abolition fucking friendly, right? Let me lower my standard a lot, right? If they were doing
abolition adjacent,
friendly, that was like, I'm not even at abolition adjacent, which people like, uh-huh. Right? You know what I mean? I'm saying abolition friendly, shit that's going to be friendly to abolitionist, transformations and creative obliterations of an existing condition of terror. If they were even doing something abolition friendly, I'd give them more room. But they are not doing that. This is some law and order shit. Ending mass incarceration, these grandstands for ending mass incarceration, what they actually are, these things are a laying down of an ideological and institutional premise to expand police power, to mm-hmm. rationalize criminalization and incarceration, mm-hmm. and to expand the reach of the carceral state, even if it involves some very modest decarceration of a small number of people, right? So you might have a modest decrease in the strictly defined incarcerated population at the same time that you are justifying that modest decrease of incarcerated people by expanding the reach of police power, expanding police infrastructure, expanding the reach of the carceral state by way of probation, by way of surveillance, by way of other forms of incarceration that don't necessarily involve jails and prisons. I have a million colleagues and fellow activists that have been doing this work, and I won't list them all here, but y'all can just Google that shit and you'll find a million people that are writing about this.
And they've been doing the work regardless of who's in power. And this gets back to what you were saying about electoral politics, which is kind of frustrating to me. And in my conversation that I had with Mike Davis, I asked him this question, and I'll ask you the same question. He wrote in a very recent piece for the New Left Review that he feels that there's a Trump faction of the Republican Party that is splintering off and forming almost a third party. Did Donald Trump succeed where Bernie Sanders failed when it comes to forming a true third party that mirrors more of the followers of the base that he created? Because what I see happening, and maybe I'm wrong here, maybe you disagree, and that's fine, is that so many people that got obsessed with Sanders during the 2016 campaign that might even been coming off of Occupy. And I do think Sanders that's the next step after Occupy, right? Your leftist-ish presidential run from a long time independent. Mm-hmm. And then you have AOC.
Yeah.
And now you have the Cori Bushes and the Jamal Bowmans of the world. But it looks like the left is all about electoral politics and people that have been doing like real deal work on the ground. We had Hannah Appel from the Debt Collective on.
Yeah, right on. Badass, yeah.
The live stream a week or so ago, and they've been doing that work regardless of who's in office.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's so much focus on we got to put more progressives in office, but we're putting them in office inside of the Democratic Party. Which is what we've been complaining about this whole time.
To be honest, Jason, I don't really complain about the Democratic Party because I don't have any hopes for them, for it. It's not a them, it's it, right? You're not going to find me doing that. You're not going to find me, I dare anybody to find anything I've ever written that is a complaint about the failure of the Democratic Party because I don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. The shit that a lot of our folks complain about the Democratic Party. That's exactly what the Democratic Party's mission statement is. Their charge, the charge of the Democratic Party. And hey, look, a century and a half ago, it was the Republican Party. You know, during Black Reconstruction, their job of the Republican Party during Black Reconstruction was to turn it into white Reconstruction, right? It was to rearm the Confederacy. So this is the mission. This is the charge of the Democratic Party, is to do exactly what we're saying here. Like what? And again, you could maybe convince me to vote for Bernie Sanders. I'll be totally transparent with you. Like, I've voted in every presidential election since I turned 18. I've never voted for either of the two party candidates. I'll vote for somebody who I really look up to, who's dead. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So that's not who I am, right? And also because the Electoral College means my vote in every state I've ever lived in doesn't fucking matter anyway. It's not gonna decide shit, right? Given that, you could maybe convince me to vote for Bernie Sanders if he actually became a candidate. Maybe. Like, if Barbara Ransby told me, dude, you better vote for fucking Bernie or I'm never going to speak to you again, I'd probably do it because I fucking love Barbara Ransby, right? And she's my friend and I respect her and I look up to her, right? Mm-hmm. So but there's not that many people that could tell me to do that and have me listen, okay? So having said that, I'm not going to stand for Bernie. I'm not a Bernie guy. I'm not a bro for Bernie. I'm none of that shit, right? But what the Democratic Party did to that dude in 2016 to kind of, you know, railroad him and make sure that Hillary Clinton got the nomination, that shit was dirty.
Dirty.
Right? And the levels of complicity beyond the Democratic Party were numerous, including CNN, including all these. I mean, so there's that piece of this, which is to say that is all indicative of the fact that this is what the Democratic Party does. So stop being disappointed in it. Stop expecting more of it, right? And maybe it's just a matter of what seems to be a subtle shift of perspective, but which ends up being a very significant shift of perspective, which is what if we look at the example of something like the Debt Collective, right? We're talking about Hannah Arendt, right? What if we look at something like the Debt Collective? They don't, in most ways, they really don't give a fuck about electoral politics, right? What they care about is creating a center of power that's actually relatively, if not completely, autonomous of electoral politics as a terrain. And so what they've ended up doing is constituting a relatively self-determined form of power, which would have been unimaginable just a few years ago, right? Now you have people who are in deep structural debt, who are creating a political identity through their shared debt and positing this audacious, compelling argument that their debt is actually the source of power. Why? Because we're going to refuse to pay your fucking debt, right? And to the extent we politicize this debt, we think about it as a form of collective identity, of collective and a premise for collective mobilization, and we refuse your shit. Suddenly the tables are fucking turned. Now financial institutions are potentially going to be beholden to you. You know, elected officials are going to be fucking freaked out. They're going to wonder what the hell is going on. Now they're going to have to come answering to you. And that you actually see them pulling this shit off, Debt Collective, right? Like I'm so happy to be part of that community. Like ever since Hannah and others pulled me into it, probably a couple of years ago is when I really got familiar with their work. But that to me is one example of how it is that you can have a community of people form. And this is overwhelmingly, I mean, this is Black folks. This is, you know, this is Brown folks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We're not working class mm-hmm. poor folks. We're people one generation removed, many of them from living in government housing and whatnot, right? Like people who've either lucked out or, through their own individual creative genius, have found their way into some form of higher education and now are in this deep structural debt that they may never pay it off the rest of their lives if it stays in place, right? To turn that into a source of power is, to me, exemplary of the way that people need to be thinking about power and political power, right? That elected officials, electoral politics, what if we thought about that shit as marginal, mm-hmm. right? Rather than being at the center of everything and being the objective of everything, you know, winning office and sending somebody here and electing somebody. What if that shit was just marginal? What if that shit was just corollary to actually constituting these communities of power to which, you know, elected officials are then beholden rather than the other way around, right? And this is to say that sometimes that can yield things like what you have in the Bay Area where, you know, and again, the historical record remains to be written about this, right? But you have things like somebody who explicitly identifies as an abolitionist actually being elected as the district attorney of a major city.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, so I'm not, Boudin, yeah. So I'm saying the historical record, and he knows this, right? He knows the history of his, you know, it's certainly, it is a historic moment, right? Him becoming, you know, this police and carceral abolitionist district attorney being elected to that office. It's a historically significant victory, right? And he knows as well as anybody, the historical record about what he does with that victory remains to be written. All right. But the point is that this victory was not won because people prioritized electoral politics, much less, you know, infiltrating the criminal justice system. It was won because you had a surge of grassroots organizing and movement that preceded this moment for at least 25 years. For at least 25 years. And that's that shit that I'm proud to say I was a tiny piece of in the mid to late 90s when I was there, right there in the Bay Area. I was a gopher. I had a gopher function, right? I was licking envelopes. I was like walking people to sit down in the, you know, in the auditorium, like, and I was learning from all these OGs in these different movements, overlapping movements that, you know, soon crystallized into what, you know, we now are calling abolition, right? But I was learning from these folks in the mid to late 90s. So I saw it. I saw it from the ground level. I saw what that organizing, what that teaching, what that politics, what that creative work, what that art, what that aesthetic, what that music. I saw what all that shit looked like. I saw the beautiful fucking mess that it was. And it was great. It was fucking beautiful. It was amazing. And it was stressful. And it was a sense of community and conflict. It was great. But all that shit is about constituting forms of power that have nothing to do with trying to win people office, right? And so that's the tension that I think we need to be really explicit about, like it, in the sense that now if we see these forms of proliferating forms of grassroots power, which don't follow any kind of script, by the way, right? Like, so when I say grassroots power, I don't mean some kind of script of here's how you do it. That's not what I mean, right? Like, I want to be respectful to people that are on anarchist tip, people in, you know, the black radical tip, people in the incarcerated in populations, like the way that people constitute power in these different places through these different, you know, kind of political commitments and ideologies, it's going to proliferate. It's going to be different. These things are all going to be in tension with each other. But that is actually, those things are actually modeling forms of power that marginalize in a productive, great way. They marginalize electoral politics. They marginalize the two parties. They marginalize the Democrats. The Democratic Party and its you know, embedded, normalized kind of internal corruption, which is not corruption because it's just how they do shit, right? So that's what I think we need to be attentive to.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I thought that was a beautiful statement. On that note, can you talk a little longer? Or are you too busy?
Of course. No, man. I'm here for you.
Okay. Well, we run this show about an hour, and we are at an hour.
All right.
If you would like to hear the other part of this conversation, where I'm going to ask Dylan more questions about Kamala Harris, I am going to get into a conversation about Van Jones because our mutual friend, I forget how Van Jones' name came up in a conversation her and I were having, and she went off on Van Jones, and you had said something similar. So I have to hear again why you guys have this disdain.
Do we have to waste our time talking about that motherfucker? Do we have
to? Right. It's just funny to me. The shit was just funny.
I'll do it
because you asked. The shit was just funny. It's just funny. So you could become a patron. It doesn't cost much. There's some bonus content that we give you. The rest of this conversation that I'm having.
I'm gonna do it right now, Jason. I'm gonna be a patron right now. I'm curious. I'm looking on your website. I'm gonna do it right now.
Hey, so thank you guys very much. Dylan, do not hang up.
I'm not. I'm here.
Can you hear some music?